Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
One of the greatest pleasures in bringing you this podcast is that we get to meet with people with a passion for what they do. This episode is no different, as we're in Baldonnel with the Irish Air Corps, as they celebrate not only 100 years of operation, but especially this week, 10 years of the Emergency Aeromedical Service, EAS. The Emergency Aeromedical Service, resident in Custom Barracks in Athlone, is a joint project between the HSE and the Defence Forces. Air Corps flight crews work alongside National Ambulance Service Advanced Paramedics in a dedicated military helicopter to rapidly transfer critical patients to the most appropriate hospital in the country. The service was initially set up in 2012 for a 12-month trial period. The aim was to assess the level and type of dedicated helicopter emergency medical service, or HEMS, required in Ireland in light of recent closures of regional facilities such as Roscommon Hospital. Well, since its inception, it's become a vital asset in critical pre-hospital care and has completed over 3,500 missions. Commandant Oisin McGrath is Officer Commanding 301 Squadron, the Tactical Helicopter Squadron.
Yeah, I suppose the first helicopters came into the Air Corps in 1963, and we had almost 40 years of search and rescue with air ambulance operations nationally, really. But I think the EAS operation, since its kind of inception in 2012, has kind of ramped that up to another level, you know, with over 5,000 missions completed in a 10-year period would probably almost match the missions that were completed over a 40-year period in the time now, in much less capable aircraft and probably a different era of aviation, I guess, more modern times now, but it's been busy, yeah.
For you as the man in charge, what are your priorities?
Safety is the number one. It has to be. You know, we're bringing civilian passengers aboard military aircraft, and everything we do in terms of training, maintenance, be it flight crews, technical crews, has to be done to the highest standards and maintain that level of safety. All incidents, minor, it happens in aviation, they're reported, and then we use those incidents to backtrack and make sure that the procedures are adjusted to make sure it doesn't happen again.
What does it actually take then, by the time somebody's sitting in the command seat of one of these helicopters, what development and training has gone in for them?
Yeah, well, I guess particularly in the command seat, at the end of the day, the aircraft commander's decision is kind of final. Why we do take CRM, which brings everybody's opinion, feeds into the aircraft commander. At the end of the day, it's that person's decision. We generally have guys with the higher end of the helicopter experience. So when a pilot comes in, from their finishing their wings course on the PC-9, they fly the EC-135 on their helicopter conversion course. It takes about 6 months to a year, depending on aircraft availability. And usually they consolidate for a year then afterwards. That builds about maybe 250, 300 hours of flying time into them, where they go and cut their teeth on their own, fly some kind of fairly basic operations. From there, they usually get a co-pilot course then on the 139, and they get maybe 3 years of sitting with the experienced guys and learn from them and see how they operate and see the decision making process and feed into it, kind of, I suppose, building their own picture of how things work. And usually after that 3 years, they have enough hours again to go into the Garda Air Support Unit and fly the 135 again as a commander. And that again takes a high level of experience to be there. They're on their own 24-hour operation, daytime, nighttime, 2-minute response. So you need guys to be I suppose on the ball in terms of decision making, and usually they stay there for kind of 3 to 5 years. which firms up their decision-making process and builds their experience on their own, I suppose, without the safety blanket of an authority over them. And then usually when they finish their time in the Garda Air Support Unit, they come back here as an aircraft commander, and that's when they feed straight into the ES system as the aircraft commander. And usually you could be looking at guys with nearly 2,000 hours flying at that point, which is a lot. It's a high-end hours. And again, it can just has to master risk.
One of those pilots that Commandant McGrath mentioned going through the training is Lieutenant Colin Delaney, currently a P2 or co-pilot on the 139. We sat into the 139 with Colin and his colleagues, Sergeant Phil Byrne, and P1 Captain Jason McDermott, the officer tasked with being responsible for the helicopter operation in Athlone. Colin explained the process that got him to the left-hand seat.
My name's Colin Delaney, and I'm a P2 on the 139. I suppose most people in helis would follow a very similar road. That's well worn at this stage, I suppose. So we start off in the PC9, you get your wings off that, and you're either, I suppose, you put forward your choice whether you want to go fixed wing or helis, and the organisation tries its best to accommodate whichever one you'd like to do.
Is there still a certain amount of suspicion amongst fixed wing pilots about heli pilots?
I suppose not there is.
I think it works the other way. They're quite inferior.
Yeah, I suppose there's definitely a healthy rivalry there as well between us. But I'm sure there's a couple of guys who've gone fixed wing probably would only like to try their hand as well at the helicopter flying and the mission scope that we cover as well. We moved across then to the 135. There was four of us in my class that went on to it, and we did that. Took about 9 months training on the 135. After that, then we spent the bones of a year doing our building and experience building before we moved across into the left-hand seat, or the P2 or co-pilot seat then in the 139. And from that, you'll build operation experience within the 139. And from there, after you have adequate experience, I suppose, but you'd move down to Athlone then in the P2 role, which for the most part, other than supporting the P1 in the operation of the aircraft, really you're looking at the planning for all the ES jobs.
I was going to ask you about that, because and we should clarify as well, because some people will be getting a little confused when you talked about the left seat and the right-hand seat, because in aeroplanes, the captain or the commander sits on the left, but in helis, it's the other way around.
Yeah, it's the other way around. There's plenty of stories of why that is, and there doesn't seem to be a general accepted truth of why it was switched.
You don't care, because when people walk past, they think you're the captain.
Oh, that's it, yeah. The P1 would be quick now to point out
who the boss is.
Who the boss is, yeah.
No, I was going to ask you a little bit about that, because the division of work in a flight deck, anyway, you know, it's not that you're sitting there just as a spare pair of hands. You have very specific duties to do.
Yeah, and I think ES probably brings that, I suppose, to the fore even more, because it is so divided down there, because a call comes in, for example, and we'll be in the mission planning office, and a call will come in from the National Ambulance Service, and whether it's a potential call or it's a tasking, what will happen then is we'll go into the planning, and the P1, if it is a task, the P1 will check the weather, and once they're happy enough that the job can be completed on a weather standpoint of view, I suppose, and other considerations, they'll walk down to the aircraft, they'll start the aircraft up, so they don't even know what the call is, I suppose, is the big difference there as well. So then up above, we'll have myself, the crewman, and the advanced paramedic then are looking at picking the PDLZ, which was spoken about before. And to be fair, we're lucky that in some instances with calls, there already exists a PDLZ quite close, so we can use that one, so it cuts down the amount of time that we need. But from, I suppose, a call coming in to taking off, it really can be brought about by how much complexity there is to the mission. So in very mountainous areas, or even in West Galway, for example, it's quite rocky, so it can be hard to find a suitable LZ there that is close enough. And if we're lucky enough to have an ambulance on scene before us, they can be brought by the ambulance to the helicopter, which I suppose makes it easier. But going back to the planning point of view, we look at the PDLZ. Once we're happy then that we have a PDLZ that will work for us ourselves, we'll walk down to the aircraft, so the three of us will walk down, and we'll go down to the aircraft. The aircraft will be already running, ready for takeoff. We'll be given the thumbs up, I suppose, literally a thumbs up from the P1, and we'll all hop on board, and then the initial heading for the direction we're going in will be given by the crewman to the P1, and then we'll go into the pre-takeoff checklist from there, and we'll do our departure. And after that point, then, you're still separated in some ways, because you're... myself as the P2 will be putting in the lat long coordinates for where we have for that PDLZ into our FMS or the GPS system on the aircraft to pick up. And then all that separation of the crew initially will all be fused together within a couple of minutes of taking off.
Captain McDermott explained more about the EAS 10th anniversary.
In 2012, June 2012, a pilot project was set up in the Midlands, we're currently based in Athlone, Custom Barracks in Athlone, DF installation. So an emergency aeromedical support service, to give it its full term, but we know it more locally as EAS. So that was set up in 2012. It was kind of set up due to the closure of some of the smaller medical facilities. So in that area was Roscommon A&E at the time. So there was a lot of concern about the local people about, you know, being the lack of medical A&E services in the area. So the solution at the time was seen to be EAS service. So a helicopter based in a medical installation or in a military installation, Custom Barracks in Athlone, as a pilot project initially, but now it has due to a success that it has seen over the last 10 years. Now this month, it has been made a permanent service and is actually more a national service now than just for the local people in the Midlands around you know, the Roscommon, Longford, Westmeath area, you know.
And so typically the decision that a helicopter is used versus an ambulance, where does that happen?
Well, it's all coordinated through the NEOC, so that's the National Emergency Operations Centre in Talla. So it's controlled by the National Ambulance Service. So their call centre, they have a floor in the Rivers building in Talla. So you have all the dispatchers that take all the 999 calls from all over the country, and they're all it's very efficient and well run setup, whereby they're all sitting on one floor, and they have immediate communications now, whether it be visually or through an intercom system. They can talk, and we have a fairly serious call here in a remote area, or we have a fairly serious call with you know, technically or medically demanding call that might benefit from the input of a helicopter. So I suppose it's really up to them, the way they categorise their calls and the way they have a kind of a flow chart, and once it hits certain criteria, they will decide then if it warrants a helicopter. So what they will do is then they'll ring our advanced paramedic that's on duty. So I suppose, to take it back again, the crew is the EAS crew is six people. So you have a pilot, a co-pilot, and a crewman EMT. And then you have the National Ambulance Service advanced paramedic, and you have two technical staff that also are double up as op staff on the job. So they'll put the NEOC then will, if they receive a call or if they identify a call that they think might benefit from a helicopter, what they would do then is they'd ring the advanced paramedic down, and he'd look at it then with his medical lens or his medical hat on. And then he'd say, yeah, the weather's good. We have the fuel. If we get the call airborne, we have full Tetra system. So we have comms with them all the time. And he'll decide then, go or no go.
Very often you'll arrive on scene, but there'll already be an ambulance in attendance. So what's the addition that you're bringing to that scenario?
Well, Michael, I suppose there's two or three different things that we can bring to that. So within the ambulance service, you have different levels or different ranks of medical qualifications and ability, the same as every organisation. And it depends on what resources they have to allocate to that call at the time. Our paramedics, our advanced paramedics, they have what's called an extended scope of practice. So they have received a higher level of training to go onto the helicopter, so they can carry a greater quantity and quality of drugs. So whether it's for pain relief or sedation or whatever, they can bring that high level of care. So it really ties in with the way the whole medical service in Ireland has developed. Once upon a time, it was kind of what they call a scoop and shoot, where you just pick someone up from the side of the road or a field or something, go to a hospital quick. Yeah. Now they focus an awful lot more on pre-hospital care, is what it's called. So a lot of the interventions and a lot of the really important time-critical life-saving stuff happens in the field, in the house, at the roadside, you know, and that's where, you know, it's time-critical. And these guys, you know, they're highly experienced advanced paramedics, and they go through a rigorous selection process to make it as far as the helicopter. So they'd be kind of at the top of the pyramid, I suppose, in their circle in the National Ambulance Service. And then, like, really, I've never seen, I'm sure they do, but they're very professional, but I've never seen them thrown by anything they ever see, you know. So that's one thing. So the pre-hospital care is one element. The second element then is that if it's in a rural location, then we're sitting here in the 139. It's the ideal helicopter for this operation, you know. Fast, long range. We cruise at 140 knots, but we can land anywhere. You know, I'll show you in a while. We have a thing called slump pads. So it's where you can spread. You can. It's an attachment for the land gear, and you can spread the weight. It's like a
soft feel for
soft feel. Exactly. Yeah. Or in the wintertime, or in the summertime, even a boggy area. So there's nowhere really that we can't learn in terms of terrain conditions. You know, so that allows us to get in close, and then obviously at the receiving facility, we can land in most locations around the country.
You talk about the base in Athlone, but where you're landing obviously is different. At this stage, you must have fairly well plotted out some good landing spots around Ireland.
Yeah, we have. Now we use a planning platform called the Health Atlas, and you know, our colleagues in the Coast Guard and ICRR will be familiar with that package, whereby it's a planning tool that we can bring up a map of Ireland, and we can we have overlays on it of the ESB wires and stuff like that, and so we can do a lot of our planning before we leave. But the P2 will have a good idea of what we can expect in terms of wires and Street View, Google Street View. So there's a lot of stuff available, but it's all in one nice concise package that leaves his planning an awful lot more straightforward. But yeah, we're up to 7,500 PDLZs, so a predetermined landing zone around the country. So it's quite an amount. You bring up the map of Ireland, and it's just like it's dotted all over with PDLZs in every county. So it is. It's quite. Now some of them we would go to scene, and you know, if someone has recently built a house on it, then we, of course, we don't land in that field. Or if there's animals, or if there's you know, at this time of the year, you know, we regularly use football pitches. They're the ideal landing site because of size that we know and are familiar with, you know. But this time of the year now, you know, football matches and kids out training and some cool camps and all the things that we're familiar with around the country. But the good thing about the sports grounds are that every town and village has a GAA club or a soccer club or a rugby club, you know. So that's a very quantifiable size that we don't have to get too tangled up in worrying about slope or, you know, pedestrian controls, where every one of them usually has a fence around it, you know. Yeah.
The technical crew is also part of the team, ensuring the helicopter is ready for an immediate dispatch. Sergeant Philip Byrne told us more.
I'm Sergeant Philip Byrne. I've been here since 2001, so a good long time. I was infantry before that, but I've been here the days before the 135 and the 139, Alouettes, Gazelles, Dolphins, Squirrels, twin engine, so good broad range.
You're mentioning some classic helicopters there, and in fact I can even see an Alouette.
Yeah, we have
in the
an
distance.
Alouette here, actually, yeah. So, we kind of worked on them all, and then 05, the 125s came, 06, the 129s came, and since then, it's predominantly 129s since, but we would, broadly work on them all anyway, so.
We're standing beside one of the helicopters now, and I suppose because people can't see, we're going to try and capture, for people, just the sheer size of it. I mean, even starting at the rotor, like we're looking at what, five blades?
Yeah, five-bladed main rotor. Fully articulated, it's medium lift, it's our workhorse. Like, I mean, I think, Jason, you can correct me, but I think there's nearly 14 different roles, 15 different roles. You're talking from what we're talking about here, the Air Islands, to firefighting with the Bambi bucket, troop transport. You were tasked with like SEAL surveys and the like by different agencies and all. So, I mean, it's an absolute workhorse. The fact that we only have six and the work we get through is phenomenal. Like, the Alouettes themselves had about 8,500 hours by the end of their life after 44 years, and we're already up on 7,000-ish hours on some of these airframes already, and they've been in since 06. So you can see the work they're getting through, you know.
And people often again associate helicopters with massive amounts of maintenance because there's so many moving parts. How does that plot out so that you have an aircraft ready every day, but then obviously you've also got to take it back in for regular maintenance?
So like we'd go on flight hours and calendar, whichever comes first, but generally flight hours, we'd be flying a lot. So like our first interval would be a 25-hour. We call it a 25-hour check. It's basically just a larger daily inspection. Our daily inspection is something like this aircraft we just finished a daily inspection on. So pretty much every point of movement on the aircraft, every point of flight safety on the aircraft is touched, looked at, assessed, and if it's right and the whole aircraft's grand, we sign that aircraft out for a 24-hour period and the aircraft's able to fly for that day. But then after that, then for 25 of those flight hours, it'll come in for a check. It's like a larger DI, a few checks on the tail, measurements, and then at different points, 100, 200, 300, you know, thereafter different calendar times then, like, you know, you have a 6 month, a 1 year, 12 month inspections that will come up periodically as they come, like, you know. And then generally from the maintenance side, we'll try and make sure that they come in staggered, not all in one lump, I mean, in practice that can be quite hard as well, as you know, availability aircraft are kind of different, you know, waiting on parts might skew that, but generally they come in, they're like, now that we're so many years with them, the maintenance is a little bit more fluid from our point of view.
How do you get this aircraft ready for a day's work?
Depending on, like, the pilots would send down recs for what jobs would come the day after, or a few days down the line, and they'll give us what fuel they need, equipment on the inside, the job it is, time on ramp, etc. And we'll configure the aircraft to what they need, bring it out then, fuel it up, and be there ready to start the aircraft. And but down that loan, then it's different again on the EAS. Pretty much a set standard, as Jason's kind of told you. We'll come down in the morning, have the aircraft ready about an hour before everybody gets there, and just have it out for when the P1 comes along. We'll do the start, and if there's any issues crop up then, like, you know, generally we can fix it there and then. But if there's anything major, the aircraft has to come back here for major maintenance. We can do up to a 25-hour, as I was saying earlier, down there, but everything else after has to be down
so
here.
So you've got all your resources and everything.
Yeah, your maintenance planning comes into things, so we'll know that's coming, so then we'll schedule aircraft changeover and, you know, keep this, so make sure there's no interruption in the service at all. Like, you know.
You mentioned coming two helicopters from infantry. What made you do that?
What was the idea?
I always wanted to be in the Defence Forces from day one, like, you know, and my father was a great salesman, so, like, you know, I was mad for the Army, like, you know, and he sold it to me that, well, in the Air Corps you can, you know, do your infantry stuff and then do your airplane stuff, like, you know, which I was interested in. So, no, it was great, great decision, like, you know, the opportunities that it opens up to you within the job itself. Like, I mean, no more than the lads, you travel all over the world on type courses, on maintenance courses, upskilling, you know, the job itself. You're never in the hangar long, you're down at loan, you hear jobs here, you could be down in Cork with the anti-terrorism stuff, you could be with the Navy, you could be with the infantry somewhere, firefighting, you know, so there's plenty of scope for it. It's never usually a normal day, there's never usually consistency in your day unless you're on like a big inspection or something like that, like, you know, so it's it.
Do you enjoy flying in them?
I do, well, I do, because I know everybody who fixes them, you know. You know, I have absolute confidence in everybody here, like, I mean, it's a great bunch of guys, like, you know, and it is something, like, you know you work in other places and you've seen operations elsewhere, and the professionalism and the way things are carried out and the adherence to safety, and it's second to none, like, you know. And you can, it's very evident when you go abroad or you see other operations, and, you know, you take it, you throw your eye on things even as you're passing by, say, wouldn't do that back home, like, you know, or, you know. So absolute supreme confidence in the aircraft, but more so the personnel,
you know. I was curious about the idea that you know, do you feel a slight bit more protective or ownership about it and lend it out to the pilots occasionally?
Absolutely. no, like, it is, it's a huge combined effort, like, you know what I mean, but you're looking at the aircraft, like, as you said, the DI every day, you're seeing the thing intimately, you're seeing little things that are either creeping that, you know, in an inspection, right, we're going to have to replace that, or, but, like, I mean, they absolutely are something that you want to look after, like, you know what I mean. And we've had these aircraft been with us since 06, as I said, so, like, I mean, they're all you kind of know then after a while, and you want to look after them, like, yeah.
Our visit to Baldonnell continues after this short break.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Jason McDermott mentioned earlier the skills of the National Ambulance crews that fly with the EAS. Well, Pat Moran has been with the service from the start.
As you correctly said, yes, I've been here since June 2012. I was one of the first cohort of six trainee APs at the time. Very new, I suppose, service, hadn't really existed within the state. And fairly short introduction to it too as well. So I suppose from both parties, you know, it got off the ground really quick.
I suppose the other thing that people might be fascinated too about is the how the services that can be offered to somebody, even 10 years later. We heard the idea of people being sort of scooped up and brought off to a hospital. Now the intervention happens on site.
Yes, I suppose if we look back, I suppose the closure of some of the local A&Es where most ambulances would have taken their patients, i.e. the nearest emergency department, I suppose that changed or had begun to change as a national policy. We had some strategies which kicked off about the same time, which are the national PCI centres, where cardiac patients, instead of, you know, going to the local ADs, were transported direct to definitive care. And I suppose that was hand in glove with the introduction of Air Corps 112 and helicopter services within the state. It allowed us to arrive on scene, diagnose the patient, and at that time we had unique access. We could consult with the consultant of the day and seek his advice, administer medication, and transport these people directly to the PCI centre. I suppose at that time there was a time issue in that 90 minutes from diagnosis to door was the prescribed time. And I suppose with the 139 at over 300 kilometres an hour, this became very achievable. So ultimately what you had happen was people that would have not probably reached that window ultimately were transported and received the care and reaped the benefit for today.
And this is a phrase that I think everybody is now fairly knows about, this golden hour or golden 90 minutes. But I'm thinking about you know, on standby for a call and your bags are packed. What do you have access to and what do you have to bring with you for a call?
So the aircraft, as I said, 139, is kitted out. There's a prescribed list. The essentials obviously wouldn't be a whole pile different from the back of an ALS or advanced life care ambulance. So you're talking about defibrillators, suction, you're talking about specific airway equipment, specific ALS drugs, and that sort of thing, you know, to manage, I suppose, acute trauma or acute medical patients in the field. So whilst, yes, we'd love to bring the kitchen sink, we're obviously bound by aviation and the max up weight that these aircraft can carry. This is a factor. But also, the difference, I suppose, from a road ambulance is that we tend to strip these things out and we put the actual bare minimum in. So we carry ones and twos where, you know, ambulances might carry fives and six. So it becomes really a daily task to make sure, first of all, that when we operate in the morning, that the aircraft is stocked and checked, and that ultimately batteries are changed and all that sort of stuff. But it's a stripped out kit that you would see in an ambulance with the benefit of some other equipment that is very specific to EAS.
And the working environment, of course, and when we can hear a helicopter going past us at the moment, it's noisy, it's moving, and let's be honest, it's not very spacious. It's spacious enough, but not very spacious.
Now, if I was a sceptic, I could say this is probably somewhat akin to an ambulance on a rocky road around rural Ireland.
Yeah.
But what I will say is, you know, coming from specifically medical and the road use into it 10 years ago, there is a transition. The aircraft environment, I suppose, you know, people see these things on television and it looks, you know, it's fantastic and it looks so smooth and it's always on a sunny day. The reality is aviation in Ireland is very different. The vast majority of the time it's very poor weather, low cloud. There's a lot going on in the cockpit. But what we tend to find, as I suppose specifically from the AP perspective, is it's a hostile environment. During the summer, if it's 30 degrees on the ground, it's 40 in the back of the cockpit. You know, the idea, I suppose, you know, if you're in an ambulance or a car, you open a sunroof or open a window. That's not a possibility, obviously, when you're airborne. And conversely, then during the winter, what you'll find is there's no in between. You know, the aircraft is a very effective heater, but it's designed to operate when the door closes or is closed. So we obviously carry a Air Corps crewman who obviously crews the aircraft into, you know, the confined areas or into the landing zones. Once that door opens, it's whatever the ambient temperature is, probably with 5 degrees on top of it again. So if it's freezing outside, it's minus degrees inside. Bad for us, but obviously, you know, conscious of our patients too as well. So it can be a challenge.
We were talking about your experience of the 10 years and now you're also going to introduce a colleague to me who's relatively new to the experience. Hi.
Michael, how are you? Tommy Monaghan, and I am an advanced paramedic generally based out of Galway, a very new recruit to the Air Medical Service.
With those fresh new eyes and the perspective of working in this environment, what crossed your mind when you thought, yeah, I've got the job, I'm going to be doing this?
Well, I suppose Pat mentioned initially that it came, it was started in 2012, and I would have only been on the road maybe 2 to 3 years at that stage. So to see the helicopter service come into use back then, I suppose they would have regularly landed in Galway and would have been a regular pad for them to locate to. And to see those guys come in, I have to say, was like, I don't want to use it really, but they would have been guys you would have really, really looked up to. They would have been the heroes of the service as such. So to further on my own career and then step into those shoes, it was like, wow, here's this opportunity. As you can imagine, I took it with both hands. Something I aimed for probably over the last 10 years myself.
And for a lot of people who, for example, might be conscious, it might be their first time in a helicopter. Even that, it must be difficult, even with small children, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. The big thing really, I suppose, is they would have ear defenders, protection from the noise, but certainly it's frightening for some patients, particularly elderly, when we're taken off. The crewman will be doing his visual assessment from the back. He'll have doors open. Patients will often reach out or feel like they're going to fall, you know, and you're trying to reassure them while all this noise is going on. Of course, there's wind blowing in through the doors. They're looking out at their feet and all they can see is a couple of hundred feet of height. So I suppose it can be a very anxious time for patients. From the bit of experience I've seen with children, it's a big novelty for them, so long as they're well enough to enjoy it, but not always the case.
I've heard they also sometimes go away with a little gift.
Oh, that's... Yeah, there is a little teddy that they get from on behalf of the Air Corps. It's that's supplied, but a nice little touch in fairness, something I was unaware of till I was here. I might even have one at home myself.
Finally, Pat, your recommendations for people, ordinary people, to get some first aid training.
Look, ultimately, I suppose, and we touched on it there briefly, I suppose one of the things that, you know, is very easy and readily available within the community is to become either a community first responder or at least receive some basic first aid training. You know, It's a very short period of time to, I suppose, reap a huge investment. I mean, with the best will in the world, if we get a phone call for someone who's had a collapse, query cardiac arrest, unless CPR takes place more or less instantly, do you know that there's a huge percentage loss in the likelihood of recovery. So I appreciate from the public's perspective, it's difficult to do, and the tendency is to stand back in these scenarios. With a little bit of training, it will give you the confidence and the encouragement, I suppose, to provide that initial care that's vital at that stage. And, you know, we've often had scenes where there's been a good recovery, you know, and what a confidence boost. Or, you know, if that doesn't make your day to be able to say that you assisted a fellow human being or ultimately were responsible for them waking up tomorrow morning, I can't think of anything else I could say, you know, that would be more beneficial.
Pat mentioned the Air Corps crewman on board too. Sergeant Dermot Corcoran has that job.
Hello, my name is Sergeant Dermot Corcoran. I'm a helicopter crewman, instructor and rating examiner in 301 Squadron in the Irish Air Corps.
Now, we've been meeting a lot of the crews today and that operate, but your function in the helicopter is quite specific.
Yeah, so I'm the rear crew. So I'm a crewman first, and then I'm also trained as an emergency medical technician. And I work closely with the advanced paramedic in the back of the aircraft. So I have a medical role and I have an aviation role. And on a day-to-day basis, I have to jump between my aviation role, the medical role. Sometimes you're in the back and you're jumping between the two of them. So I have to stay tuned in to what's going on with the patient. And then I might get the pilots coming on the front to update me with weather and what's going on and stuff like that. So we kind of have to have a left and a hand in, you know, both the ears.
Putting both cams,
exactly,
basically.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah, when you're doing that. And, you know, I would see you and your colleagues, actually, somebody's been wearing a harness there because you're actually, it's sometimes outside the helicopter practically.
Yeah, a lot of people ask, what do we do and why do we stand outside? So just this morning I had the new crew course up in the mountains. So we were going into literally forest tracks, turning circles. And the reason we can go in there because the crewman is out and the pilot is in the front. He's on the right, or on the 139, he's on the right-hand side. And I stand on the right and the P2 is the pilot monitor and he's on the left. So our main job is we're the eyes and ears of the pilot. So we can go into an area where he can't see the tail, he can't see what's underneath the aircraft. Mm-hmm. So through patter, I'm basically talking him into the area. So between myself and the pilot, he has his references, and my job is then. So that's why we stand out there, is we basically have the eyes and the ears. It's all about the situational awareness.
That's we're fierce handy parking.
I like to think, yeah, you see the scrapes of my van and stuff, but yeah, basically that's kind of it. Like, you have to be very spacious, yeah, aware, right. You know, your timing has to be right. Then you have to link in with an air traffic control call with a checklist, so you have to know when to cut in, cut out, yeah. So you have to tune into the two of them. So on EES, when it goes into like that, when we're on the aircraft, when we're coming into approach, we'd be getting updates from scene. But once we go into our landing procedure, our 5S recce, the pilot goes through his 3Es, his entry, exit, and emergency. It's a sterile cockpit then. Right. So we might have to wait until we get the wheels on to get in touch with the National Ambulance Service again, because we could be going into corner of a field, there could be a barn, there could be, I went over where hens come out of things, I've been in places where I got bits of silage wrap coming up on me, so we always have to be aware of what's going on outside, so it goes into a sterile
and that's
cockpit.
Interesting what you talk about, this idea of a sterile cockpit, that means there's no non-operational conversation at that moment.
No, so all the kind of chat, the chit-chat has stopped, we go into a patter, we go into our procedures, so there's no interference, there's no, oh, we'll have a look at this, have a look at that, it's a set line down procedure, and you don't go off that procedure, and then the wheels are down, and everyone's in there safe, because the most important thing for us is getting there safe. I'm sure some of the pilots have said as well, they pick up on, they have to do the call cold, so when he finds out what the call is, we just tell him, or the advanced paramedic will tell him, we're going to Bundoran or we're going to Monaghan town. He looks at the weather, he sees that's fine, he's gone, so he makes that decision. So that's where it starts from there.
So how did you end up in this position?
Yeah, so I joined the Defence Forces back in 2003. 19 years now. So I joined originally to get into the search and rescue side of things, because I was quite a strong swimmer and stuff. My dad was a guard, so I kind of had that growing up, you know, helping people from that side of things. Mm-hmm. Trained as a heavy diesel mechanic then, and finished up with that, and then the crew course came up. So it comes through the local order, the routine orders, and you go for a selection course. One of the few units in the Defence Force that runs a selection course. It's a full week. Have to do an interview, so it started off at 75 was whittled down to 23, and 12 was finished, and they took on 2 to start. So that's how you get into it. So the selection course is it's robust, and there's a fitness test in it, a bleep test in it, a dummy drag, a rope pull. Then you have a lot of classroom work. You have to learn your patter. You have a fly-in test. You have the downwash test, was the hardest thing to pass. So you're in the middle of the lake, bring the aircraft down over top of you, low level, and you have to swim out from underneath the downwash. Jump off the lake, then you have a fly-in test as well, so it's a very busy and robust week. And then you have it's called a pool test, but it's basically the push it to your limits in the pool, so you have a pool test as well.
You also, as you say, as well as being a crewman, you also have paramedic skill as well.
Correct, yeah, we're multi-medical technicians, so when we go on scene to a call, whatever the call is, we'll all get into the aircraft after the pilot has started up. We'll get our PDLZ, we've done all that. So then when we get on scene, then sometimes we're first on scene, and sometimes there's a road crew who've gotten there just before. So I have to get involved in the medical side of things as well. So depending on the nature of the casualty and what's going on. So one of the instances was an RTC we went to. I basically had to, so I'm loading everyone up. I had to take the mother of the young boy, get her into the aircraft. I have to keep an eye on the 6 paramedics that are helping the advanced paramedic on the ground. I have to keep an eye on my aircraft, I have to keep an eye on my 2 pilots. I have to make sure the 2 firemen who are cutting the gate, the fire site, can stop. So I have to organise the scene. So you have on-scene management, then you have to load everyone into the aircraft, get people back away from the aircraft. This is all why the engine and the rotors are still running. Load people up. I have to go then get everyone strapped in, make sure the advanced paramedics are in. If you have family members, the patient's all right, confirm with him, we're good to go. Me and the pilot then, they will get into our sequence for taking off. We take off then, we shut the door, gone through all that. He'll go back on to, so we have a patient in the back, we go to the cab isolated, then I go back into helping in the back with the patient. So on that day, we were doing CPR for 25 minutes between myself and the advanced paramedic. I was drawing up drugs. I was doing CPR on the patient. You're also trying to keep the parent who's in the back calm. Then we had an agreement when we come into Dublin that he'd go back doing CPR, I go back to landing the aircraft, we land the aircraft successfully, safely again, go back into our procedures, we unload the patient into the back of the ambulance, then we'll go to the, sometimes I travel to the hospital with the paramedic, or sometimes we'll go back to Baldonnell or wherever to get fuel.
I'm curious when friends or relatives ask, what do you do? What kind of, you know, short version you can give them? Because it sounds quite complicated.
It is, you know, we kind of tell them, you know, you're a helicopter winchman or you're a helicopter crewman. Well, what does that do? And then you're trying to describe some of the things we do. And it's like, oh, I didn't realise you did that. Oh, I didn't know you did that. And then, of course, I'm sure the Coast Guard lads get it themselves. Everything's in the Coast Guard. But when you explain what you do for a crewman's role, we're door gunners, we're EMTs, we're general purpose crewmen, we do cargo singing, Bambi ops, neonatal transfers, patient transfers, EAS, bog surveys, river surveys, seal surveys, sniping from the aircraft with the special forces insurgent, we're door gunners, winchmen, we're starting to run a rescue swim, of course, now as well. So you're kind of a one stop shop for everything. So it's definitely interesting and it's busy. So it's enjoyable as well.
Sergeant Dermot Corcoran there. Well, let's leave the last word with Commandant Oisin McGrath, the officer commanding 301 Squadron. With 10 years done, what are his hopes and plans for the next 10 years?
Well, I think for the future would be to become a much better resourced service in terms of pilots, technicians, new aircraft, an increased base where we are, or a new base somewhere else that we would have a much more permanent structure. You know, where while it's fine and it's a detachment and it works, it's still a tent. It's a hangar tent rather than a concrete hangar. I'd like to see a purpose-built area for EES, whether that be on a site in the Midlands or whether it be wherever that is. I'm sure somebody higher made that call, but that would be nice. And then to have it fully resourced, you know, have a full roster there. I'd like to see it as a squadron on its own. It falls under 301 Squadron, which already we deal with special force operations, international air ambulances, we deal with firefighting, we deal with troop transport, we deal with marine counter-terrorism, naval ops. And then EAS is just this add-on that we have when actually it should be a fully structured squadron with a squadron commander, 2IC, and a bunch of pilots and air crew attached to it, and it should be fully self-sufficient, similar to the air support unit.
It's something you said earlier on, you know, about civilians on a military helicopter, but and also then you've the Garda support unit and liaisons with other operations like the National Ambulance.
I would say, safely say, that the relationship between the departments, be it Health and Defence and then the HSE and the National Ambulance Service and the Air Corps, are pretty strong, and the relationships are good. So
the organisation's recruiting. What would your encouragement be to somebody who thinks that, yeah, maybe there is a career in that for me?
You'd need to think of it from a two-stream, I suppose, approach. One is the flying, like military aviation. It's impossible to beat. I won't say it's hard to beat. It's unbeatable, really. You don't do this kind of flying in any other organisation. Other organisations will be very specific in one role. You're looking at multi-role pilots. You've got currencies, you could have 10, 12 different currencies to maintain, be it fast roping, be it bambi bucketing, cargo slinging, and all of those things we do on night vision goggles at night time. So you could have 20 currencies to maintain, which just keeps the level of excitement up on the flying side. And equally on the other side is the camaraderie, the friendships, the involvement in sport, the support that you get as an individual rather than a pilot is incredible. So yeah, I'd highly, highly recommend it. I'm looking back at my own career, 20 years coming up in September now, I'd actually look back and not change any day of it. So,
our thanks to the Irish Air Corps for their help and hospitality this week. We look forward to returning soon to Baldonnell to mark more events as part of Air Corps 100.
To get the news first, subscribe now to Squawk 7000 on your favourite podcast platform.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.